This is Professor Bill Taubman of the Political Science Department at Amherst College, and I am here to interview Joel Paul, who is a former student of mine, but who has since gone on to much bigger and better things. He is a professor of law and associate dean of international and graduate programs at the University of California, Hastings, where he teaches public international law, international trade law, constitutional law, international business transactions, and foreign relations law. But what we're here to do today is to discuss his new book, which is called Unlikely Allies: How a Merchant, a Playwright, and a Spy Saved the American Revolution. Well, Joel, I want to begin by saying that given that list of what you do and what you teach, you sound, if I can paraphrase your title, like an unlikely author of your book, Unlikely Allies. So how did you get onto this, or into this, shall we say?
Well, I was writing a history on international law in U.S. courts, and I was trying to find a way to describe the improvisational quality of American foreign policy at the start of our republic, and how we had to invent international law as we went along. And I came across this story about this Connecticut merchant named Silas Deane, who had never left Connecticut in his life and couldn't speak a word of French and didn't know anything about international diplomacy. And in 1775, Ben Franklin decided that he was the perfect man to send on a secret mission to persuade the French king, Louis XVI, to arm the Americans against the British, because Franklin thought he was so improbable, the British would never suspect him. And as I got into the story and discovered more about him through his own papers, I saw that he had succeeded with the help of a French comic playwright and a cross-dressing spy, and I thought I would maybe put aside my original plans to write a book about the history of international law and kind of pursue this for a while.
Well, that leads to a question based now on your subtitle, How a Merchant, a Playwright, and a Spy Saved the American Revolution. And that question is, how did they?
Well, the Silas Deane got to France, and he had no real financial resources. He had no wherewithal to go about obtaining arms. He had no credibility with the French court. But he eventually put together a smuggling operation with the help of Caron de Beaumarchais, who is the French playwright who wrote The Marriage of Figaro and The Barber of Seville. And he and Beaumarchais together managed to obtain and smuggle all of the arms, ammunition, and uniforms for an army of 30,000 men and get it to the Americans just in time for the crucial Battle of Saratoga.
Now, your heroes of this story are, as we know from your subtitle, a rather odd lot. And that's particularly unusual in a book about the founding and the revolution, because we're so used to having the founders treated, the famous founders, we all know their names, Adams, Jefferson, Washington, all the rest, treated as heroes, and yet your heroes are, as I say, a bit strange, and the in some ways, and the regular founding fathers with whom we're acquainted come across as even stranger, shall we say. Franklin, you portray as luxuriating in the public's adoration and a frequent visitor to a gay bathhouse. Jefferson, you describe as paying someone to steal Deane's personal papers so that he can find dirt on Deane and John Adams. So my question to you is, what have you got against the Founding Fathers?
Well, teaching constitutional law, I have a great admiration for the Founding Fathers. But I do think that when we set the Founding Fathers on a pedestal, that we fail to appreciate the fact that these were real men with real human frailties, and that they had to overcome their own weaknesses to found a nation. I think the founding fathers were extraordinary, but they were not always as worthy as the cause they fought for. I don't think our revolution succeeded because we were led by extraordinary men so much as because the men who did leave us, who did lead us, rose to the challenge. And I guess my hope is that my book will empower people to believe that they can make a difference, even if they're not so extraordinary.
Well, you know, you know, I'm sure of the, and probably our listeners know of the so-called great man theory of history, which in this day and age would have to be called the great person theory of history,
mm-hmm.
And how that theory has been challenged, especially in recent decades, by social historians and others who talk about impersonal forces of all sorts, economic, cultural, social movements that are, they argue, even more important than the so-called great men. I'm tempted to conclude that what you're offering here is a not-so-great man theory of history. That is, it's not vast movements of peoples or anything else like that. It's still a few men. It just turns out that they're not so great.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you've written about a couple of great men yourself, Stalin and Khrushchev.
Thank you for the plug. This is I guess we should call this a plug within a plug.
Yes. I think that great men and women do, in fact, have an enormous impact on history, and I also think that great social movements and ideological movements are also important in shaping history. But I think just as important, history, like life itself, is oftentimes shaped by accidents. And we can only look at the recent events in Egypt and in the Arab world and see how an anonymous young man peddling fruit is denied a license, and he sets himself on fire in protest, and his single act of protest seemed to ignite the Arab world in a way that nothing else could. So I think sometimes that anonymous individuals, people on the fringes of society, accidents, coincidences, can also have a profound effect on history, and that's sort of what I'm exploring here.
Well, now there's another place in here where you talk of how virtuous men and women often make a mess of what they're doing or act hypocritically or even criminally.
Yes.
And hypocrites end up as the creators and the good guys. You seem to be drawn thus to paradox and contradiction and irony. How far would you take that? Would you say that it is positively a disadvantage to be virtuous and an advantage to be hypocritical when it comes to making history?
I hope not, but I think it is true that, as we all know, that history tends to be written by the victors. In the case of my book, I think that people like the famous Lee family of Virginia managed to craft American history in a way that they looked like they were great patriots. And my book exposes the fact that in fact they were oftentimes motivated by their own economic self-interest. Yet, in a way, I think that in the end of my book, although Dean is unfairly maligned and impoverished and dies in ignominy, in fact he's murdered, I hope that my book is an effort to try to rehabilitate his reputation. And I think that some of the other, that one of the advantages of history is that we can look back in time and we can find heroes and we can celebrate those people who were virtuous.
When you say that the Lee, Arthur Lee, correct?
Yes.
Crafted history so as to appear to be a hero when in fact he wasn't. Do you mean he crafted the writing of history? He crafted somehow he he set things up so that historians would write favorably about him, or was it that he simply acted in his time in a way that was misleading?
Well, he himself didn't write history, although his brother Richard Henry Lee wrote a famous biography of Arthur Lee.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in his time, the Lee family, because they were successful, they portrayed themselves as being selfless servants of the people, heroes of the revolution. In fact, they had a great deal of their family money tied up in a real estate investment in the Ohio River Valley. And there was a competing land syndicate led by Benjamin Franklin, in which Silas Deane had also invested. And they blamed Franklin and his land syndicate for the economic problems their family faced. And I think that they were very vicious in going after both Franklin and Deane. They succeeded in destroying Deane's reputation, not Franklin's reputation. But at the same time, they portrayed themselves as if, you know, they were above reproach. In fact, although Arthur Lee entered public service very poor and really entirely dependent on help from his brothers, he retired from public service a very wealthy man, having abused his public office to obtain other lands from the Indians. While Silas Deane, by contrast, was a wealthy merchant who ended up in poverty, having served the public selflessly.
It's interesting. You're in effect depicting the Lees as early masters of spin.
Yes,
that is of portraying what they had done in a way that historians and observers would pick them up as the heroes.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's media, of course, wasn't quite so advanced as it is today, but they were
Well, I remember Arthur Lee on Facebook.
No, I don't think that they were tweeting that or anything that. But they definitely had a way of portraying themselves, and they had a great deal of support in Congress. They were aligned, as you know, with the Adams family, not the Charles Adams family, but the Adams family of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lee Adams junto really controls Congress for during the period of the American Revolution to a large extent, and managed to give them a platform from which to portray themselves in a more favorable light.
It's interesting. You say that the Lees didn't give credit, or in effect made Franklin look less important and constructive than he was. But isn't it true that Franklin gets a lot of credit from historians like Stacy Schiff, for example, for negotiating the alliance with France that won the American Revolution? But now here you come along and say that it wasn't Franklin but Silas Deane. So you are, or am I wrong in interpreting that to be your view?
No, that is my view, and that was also, interestingly, Ben Franklin's view, that Franklin himself gave Deane most of the credit. In fact, there's a problem with the argument that historians make crediting Franklin, and that is that before Franklin had even arrived in France, all of the arms and the ammunition and the uniforms for the Continental Army had already been obtained, loaded on board ships, and those ships were already on route to the American states before Franklin had arrived in France. So it's hard to say that Franklin was responsible for those arms, and most historians would agree that the arms having arrived before the critical Battle of Saratoga, which was the turning point of the war, they were instrumental in ultimately not just winning the Battle of Saratoga, but in persuading the French government to support the Americans with a treaty of alliance, which, by the way, Deane himself drafted, not Franklin.
Now, so far, we've been, for the most part, pretty serious in our discussion here, but... But this book is, as reviewers and others have said, really a kind of particularly rollicking romp through American history. It's engaging and entertaining. It's about these three incredibly colorful characters. It's hard to believe, you know, that it's true, but it obviously is. And in that connection, one thing that struck me was that part of the story is a romance between the playwright Beaumarchais and the spy, the French minister to Britain, the Chevalier Dion. And this is particularly interesting because one isn't sure whether about the gender of the Chevalier Dion. He starts, the character starts out as a he, I think, and then ends up as a she in the book. And frankly, by the end, I wasn't quite sure what he was. And so all of this leads me to praise the book because it's so damn much fun following all of it. It's almost like a bedroom farce. But am I right that you avoid describing the characters in your book as either bisexual or gay? So could you address this question of what actually is going on and your approach to it?
Sure. I think that it's somewhat difficult for us to superimpose categories on people from the 18th century, like gay or straight or bisexual. Those categories didn't exist in those times, and as a gay author, I'm especially sensitive to the historiography of sexuality as a social construct. I think that whatever the actual feelings were between Beaumarchais and Chevalier Dion, there was certainly some kind of homoerotic element to it, and at least I think from Dion's point of view, it appeared that he or she was genuinely seduced by the playwright Beaumarchais. And so I, rather than labeling them in one way or another, labeling their relationship one way or another, I just sort of told the story. And if people choose to see it as a bisexual or a gay relationship, that's okay.
Well, now I'm going to ask a question which may in itself be insensitive or wrong-headed, but when you yourself say he or she, what does that mean?
Well, I tried, one of the challenges in the book was I was trying to find a way to respect the fact that the Chevalier Dion began his life as a man for 40 years. He was a French diplomat, an accomplished political scientist, a spy, and the French minister to Britain. And then he meets Beaumarchais and announces that he is in fact a woman who's been pretending to spend the first 40 years of her life as a man, but is in fact a woman. And she spends the next 40 years of her life as a woman. And I tried to honor her identification as a woman and as a man by referring to her as he when he was a him and she when she was a her.
Yeah, okay.
And it's somewhat confusing in the book,
yes.
I know. But I that was kind of a stylistic choice I made.
I see. Well, I think our listeners will understand that after some of this conversation that this book is a candidate for a movie. And that thought occurred to me, and then lo and behold, when you sent me your short biography or your biographical sketch, I was delighted to see at the end that it says he, that is you, is currently writing a screenplay of the book. Now, I must say I'm interested in that for lots of reasons. One of them is that I've often thought about the possibility of my biography of Khrushchev becoming a screenplay, and
it would be a terrific screenplay.
Or an opera, actually. I saw Nixon in China the other night and thought I began to imagine Khrushchev in America, but this is all irrelevant. The point is that as I thought about it, it began to seem overwhelmingly difficult to boil down a long, complicated book with all the nuances that can be expressed in 200 or 300 or 400 or 500 pages into a screenplay. So I'm, are you actually doing this? And if so, can you talk about the challenges involved therein?
Sure. Well, I am actually writing a screenplay. It's about half done. I've been working on it for some time. I've been taking screenwriting classes.
I see.
As you know, I live in Northern California, and when you live in Northern California, everybody has a screenplay they're working on. So it's not difficult to find screenwriting classes.
So you can take a course from your neighbor?
I can. And so I've been very active in that, and I've actually pitched the screenplay to a number of major studios. And I actually have someone in Hollywood who's gotten a little bit of nibbles, but nothing too promising yet, to try to option the screenplay. The challenge for writing, if you're turning a book into a screenplay, is really trying to turn words into scenes and trying to create visual images. One of the things you learn about screenplays is that they're sort of written like haiku. The fewer words on the page, the better. They want lots of white space. And so for someone like us who are academics, it's a challenge because we're not used to thinking that way. But trying to find a way to portray something rather than to describe it with words is the challenge of putting together a screenplay. And it's been a lot of fun.
Then you say portray rather than describe with words, but a screenplay consists of words. So how are you? You mean you're describing a scene rather than which in itself will convey what's in your book as words, but you're using words.
Right, but you give very few descriptions of what the characters look like or what the characters are thinking or feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, you're describing an action. You know, the action might be something as simple as one character takes another character's hand, and we understand that as being a sign of affection.
Mm-hmm.
Or a character leaves a room quickly and shuts a door, and we understand that, you know, that may express something about what took place prior
mm-hmm.
to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a challenge, but it's been a lot of fun writing it.
Well, as a lawyer and a law professor who has written the history and is now trying to turn it into a movie, your story, your own history, raises a question that, which is the role that your Amherst education played in all of this. What did you encounter or learn at Amherst which helps to explain this story of your own, shall we say?
Well, I was a public school kid when I came to Amherst. I don't think that I knew how to write well or how to think critically before I got there. I studied the Founding Fathers with professors like Henry Steele Commager and Bob Gross. I learned about international diplomacy from Gordy Levin. And, of course, you, Bill, were responsible for supervising me in writing a 200-page thesis for my major. And
economic sanctions against Rhodesia, wasn't that it?
You are quite extraordinary. I'm sure you've supervised a few theses since then. But
well,
just the fact that you could remember
it to memory, yeah.
Just the fact you could remember that, it shows something about the nature of the college and the relationship between the faculty and the students that I think is so special. And really, working with you on that thesis taught me how to organize a massive amount of research and to write and to think critically and organize my thoughts. And those skills have served me very well as a professor and as an attorney.
Mm-hmm. Well, that leads to perhaps a final question, or perhaps not final, but this is always asked in interviews, so let's follow the standard procedure, which is, what are you writing next?
Well, I am now working on a sequel about American diplomacy after Silas Deane, which is called Extravagant Pretense, how Chief Justice John Marshall invented American diplomacy, and it's going to hopefully be coming out in 2013 with Penguin Press. It's the story of Chief Justice John Marshall, who many people know is one of the formative figures in American constitutional law. But before he was a member of the Supreme Court, he was a diplomat, he was Secretary of State, and as a member of the Supreme Court, he had a really important influence in constructing the basic principles of international law that are still with us today. In many of these cases, these were cases about pirates and slaves and Indians, Marshall didn't know much about international law, so he sort of had to make stuff up to deal with these unusual problems. And the principles he invented are still the principles that are the basic constructs for our international diplomacy today.
Is this going to be, as somebody who is an academic and has tried to write books that are of interest both to academics and to the general reader, I hesitate to ask this question, but is this book that you're working on now more academic, would you say, than Unlikely Allies, or do you, like me, actually want to erase that distinction for all practical purposes?
Well, my publisher certainly hopes that it's not going to be a purely academic book, and it's not my intention to write it as a purely academic book. It's really going to be Unlikely Allies, something which I think will be a fun, lively story about some really interesting characters and an important period of time in American diplomacy, and hopefully it'll also shed some understanding on why America often finds itself today as being the odd man out in international diplomacy.
When you teach your law courses, to what extent do you appear or in the voice that we encounter in a book like Unlikely Allies? That is, are you do you reach in your teaching for the kind of accessibility and engagement and just plain fun that is visible in a book like this, or do you put a scowl on your face and come across like a law professor?
No, well, I often think of my constitutional law class at Amherst with Earl Latham, who was, as you will remember, was a master of wit and an irony, and I aspire someday to be as funny and as wise as Earl was, I know that one of my students recently read my book and came to see me just yesterday, and she said, you know, when I was reading your book, I could just hear your voice from class so much. So I guess my classes must sound a little bit like the book does. Although I don't spend quite as much time talking about cross-dressing French spies in my classes.
I see. Well, having been a young colleague of Earl Latham's, and in some ways he was actually my mentor, I can't think of a more wonderful goal than to live up to his example, which in my own way I've been trying to do too. So the College on the Hill produces a wonderful teacher like Earl Latham, and in your person a wonderful student who goes on to a wonderful career as a teacher and now a writer yourself. It's been great talking to you, and I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much, Bill.